This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll hear about another instance in which the FBI illegally surveyed a Muslim leader at his local mosque.
This frame-up is only one of many. You'll hear about a national effort to catalog, create a website, and talk about the some 400 cases, most of them wrongly framed.
We talk with Professor Michael Haas, who's just come out with a new book, George W. Bush, War Criminal? Question mark?
Stay with us.
Over the course of the next few shows, we're going to try and give you a scorecard update about how the Obama administration is doing on issues such as torture, Guantanamo, secrecy, etc. Well, here's update number one, combining a little bit of two updates, but it's really about Guantanamo and enemy combatants. We all know that Obama issued an executive order in mid-January or late January saying that Guantanamo should be closed within a year, setting up a process, not making a final decision as to whether people would be tried or repatriated, or what we call the nasty third basket of preventive detention, which, of course, we should all oppose. That's not decided yet, but Obama is on his way to at least doing something there, but it may not turn out well if he sets up preventive detention. On Friday the 13th of February, the Obama administration did what I called pulled a George Bush. What they did at 4 o'clock in the afternoon on Friday, they issued a press release bragging about the fact that Obama was no longer going to use the term enemy combatant regarding the people held at Guantanamo, and it was no longer, like Bush had done, it was no longer going to depend on commander-in-chief power to hold those people, but instead was going to look to acts of Congress. Sounds great. In fact, I got emails saying, no more enemy combatants, no more commander-in-chief power. And then, of course, it's not even the devil in the details. The devil is the fact that he issued a press release at 4 o'clock that then got picked up with headlines that said Obama abolishes enemy combatant, no longer asserts power as commander-in-chief. But when you read the brief actually submitted to the court, which is, of course, what goes to my office because we represent Guantanamo detainees, it talks about what actually he did. It's true. We are no longer calling the people at Guantanamo enemy combatants. Well, if they're not enemy combatants, what are they? Well, they're enemies. They're members of the opposition forces. There are a bunch of other euphemisms. But the real point is no longer enemy combatants, but the definition is almost the same as the one used for enemy combatants. So there's literally no change in the idea that you can hold people who are members of Al-Qaeda, members of the Taliban, members of their supporting forces, members who've done this or that, or people who've trained or supported, associated with. The only word is he made one word change in the definition of what was the definition of enemy combatant, now the definition of an enemy opposing force, a one-word change. Instead of support, it says substantially support. So we wind up with a press release that's misleading from the Obama administration, not just misleading, but disingenuous, because the definition winds up to be the same. So we don't have enemy combatants, but we have members of enemy forces. The bottom line is that people have been in Guantanamo now for 7 years, will soon be going on their eighth year, and who knows how much longer. Thank you, Barack Obama.
Heidi, what did you think of remembering now that Bush got up and gave one of his historical speeches, the United States does not torture, and then the International Red Cross documents came out. Mark Danner revealed in the New York Review of Books about what they did to these people they had incarcerated. What did you think of that?
Well, we knew they were doing this kind of thing, but to see it in print and to see the things being described, which I don't see how anyone could say bashing your head against a wall, waterboarding isn't torture.
Soaking them in cold water, making them stand naked for 3 days, all of this being transmitted right back to the White House so that everybody knew, the attorneys in the White House, the Defense Department, they all knew, and they were calling the shots on this, and they had their lawyers say that this was okay. because they just redefined what torture was.
It's just, again, an issue of semantics.
What's stunning about this is the first real Red Cross report that apparently a journalist got a hold of and felt free enough to write about what they did. And it's a Red Cross report that's based on interviews with 14 people that were sent from secret sites to Guantanamo. And when they got to Guantanamo, the U.S. let them be interviewed. This is somewhat after they were tortured. And the stories are accurate because none of these people ever got to talk to each other, and yet their stories match. And Mark Danner wrote the piece in both the New York Times, a short piece, and in the New York Review of Books called U.S. Torture, Voices from the Black Sites. These are people who were at the black sites. When you read it, it's completely horrendous. I just read the table of contents, which he actually publishes, from the Red Cross report. It's called Main Elements of the CIA Detention Program. And the words are sort of neutral a little bit, arrest and transfer, but then the next word, continuous solitary confinement and incommunicado detention. Then other methods of ill treatment. They don't call it waterboarding. They have a better term, suffocation by water.
That's precisely what it is.
That's what it is. Prolonged stress, standing, because I read it, they would hold people up on a chain, up on a bar above their head, with their toes just touching the ground, with their handcuffs on the bar for weeks at a time. People would fall asleep there. And they said, when you looked at the people's wrists who they interviewed, the Red Cross interviewed, they all had the scars and the bruises from the cuts of the handcuffs from being suspended for weeks at a time. That's called prolonged stress standing.
And what does that do to the circulation?
It's not good, Heidi. Bloats your legs. It's a serious, it
can
kill you.
You can actually die from
it.
Yeah.
And then another one's called beatings by use of a collar. That's what Michael was describing as hitting against the wall. But here's what it actually is. They put a collar around your neck with a chain on it, and you're naked, and they throw you against the wall as hard as they can repeatedly. And one of the people who this happened to said he noticed that while he was strapped in a bed, they were doing something else to him when he was naked. They saw him putting a piece of plywood on the concrete wall.
Yeah.
And the reason they were doing that is so it didn't show injuries when he hit the wall with the collar on. So, I mean, this is an update, but it also includes confinement in a box. That's another title of the Red Cross table of contents. That's where they make a coffin-like box of two heights, one your height and one smaller. And after they go through the collar against the wall, the waterboarding, then they put you for hours and days into a box where you can't even stand up. It's 3.5 feet high, forgot that they said a couple feet wide, and you stay in that box. And they put a cloth over the front of the box, like a coffin, so you can't see any light and it has trouble breathing. I mean, we could go on and on with these.
It's like being buried alive.
It's devastating. What the Red Cross concludes, as Danner quotes the paragraph, the allegations of ill treatment of the detainees indicate that in many cases, the ill treatment to which they were subjected while held in CIA program, either singly or in combination, constituted torture. In addition, many other elements constituted cruel, inhuman, or degrading treatment. As Danner says, it's a stark, an unmistakable conclusion. And I think you want to conclude this by asking a couple things. One, why has there been no huge stink about this? Why have we barely read about this report except that one day in the Times and the New York Review of Books? Why did the Washington Post, when they carried the story, actually put quotation marks around the word torture as if it still is in question? And why do we not have prosecutions of the torture conspirators?
We have to look forward, not backward.
Well, that's a quote from Obama.
That's the reason.
He says we want to look forward. But, of course, as you and I and Heidi have always said, looking forward means prosecuting people because that's the way you look forward to a future without torture. Dahya Hashad, we're glad to have you again back as one of our four hosts. Occasionally you're here. Now I know you're in Washington. For our listeners who I'm sure remember, Dahya Hashad is with Amnesty International. And Dahya, why don't you begin with a quick update?
Absolutely. From here in Washington, some things have changed from the Bush administration and some things unfortunately haven't. And we have a good update for you and a not so good update. Let's start with the good. In December, the UN passed a declaration upholding the universality of human rights, regardless of sexual orientation or gender identity. They also condemned the criminalization of same-sex conduct between adults. In over 80 countries around the world, it is illegal for same-sex adults to be in a romantic relationship. the U.S. was the only Western nation that refused to sign the U.N. Declaration in December, but Obama has announced that his administration will sign on. And this sends a really important message, not just domestically, but around the world, about what it means for us to believe in human rights and to believe in human rights for everybody. So that's a bit of good news.
How many countries have signed it, Dahlia?
I'm not sure. I think about 66.
Does it actually have any meaning?
It has a very strong meaning, unfortunately a little bit symbolic like a lot of the declarations, but what it means is that we're expanding the whole host of human rights for all people regardless of their identity. And this is something that's been relatively recent. We're talking last 10 years, it's been really recognized that regardless of sexual identity, you have a right to both practice the lifestyle that you are destined to lead and that you want to lead, but that you also have the right to access all other human rights that you're often prevented from accessing because of your sexual identity. So, for example, the right to housing is often impeded because of people's sexual identity, their right to work. And that's just, we're talking about in the United States and other Western countries, but in some places, you can receive the death penalty for being gay.
Here on Law & Disorder, we have discussed numerous cases exposing frame-ups or wrongly convicted Muslim men related to the, quote, war on terror. We look at yet another case today involving an Iraqi Kurd, Yasin Aref, who came to Albany, New York in 1999 as a refugee from Kurdistan, Iraq. He later became the leader at a local mosque. After 9/11, the FBI began to illegally wiretap and eavesdrop on the mosque and on Yasin. It was later reported in the New York Times that these wiretaps were conducted without court approval. We talk with Stephen Downs, a retired New York State attorney and a volunteer lawyer on Yasin Aref's legal defense team. He will tell us an incredible story of exactly how the FBI monitored Yasin. The FBI used a convicted felon to frame him with terror-related charges. This story is also the subject of a documentary titled Waiting for Mercy, produced by Ellie Bernstein. Stephen Downs joins us today.
Steve Downs, welcome to Law & Disorder.
Good to be with you.
Steve, this is a very special case. It's a New York State case, and it concerns an imam named Yasin Aref. And I think most of our listeners probably have never heard of this case. They may have some vague memory of an Albany mosque or something. I mean, I did, and I follow this closely. But give us the lay of the land here on what's the injustice here? What's this case about?
Right. This is a case in which the Justice Department, the FBI, decided to target this particular imam.
What year was that, Steve?
Well, it started back in 2004, I think would be the earliest period. We don't actually, to be honest with you, we don't really know. It could have been earlier, and it seems clear that this is it's an unusual case in that the FBI began to illegally wiretap him very early on under the NSA program, and we know that because at one point when the NSA program was under some fire, a government spokesman went on and said, oh, no, this is a great program. It helped us catch an imam in Albany, New York.
Wow, that's amazing, you know, because we obviously, my office follows this closely, and we have lawsuits. But so he was one of the open victims or targets of the warrantless wiretapping program.
Yes, no question about it. And that this has hovered like a cloud over the whole case because, for example, we would ask for exculpatory information. They were claiming that he had, for example, called, made 15 calls to his office, his old office back in Syria, and that this was somehow connected with terrorism. And we said, fine, produce the calls. We'll show that he was just calling friends and then making routine inquiries. They never responded to that. They never said whether they had to call the tapes or they didn't have the tapes.
Quite remarkable,
and,
really.
Yeah, the whole Brady issue was never taken up by the court. And in fact, the court went up on the appeal. I'll just quickly jump ahead of myself here
sure.
to say that the case went up to the Second Circuit, and the Second Circuit took the position that he did not raise a colorable claim that he had been illegally wiretapped, even though a government spokesman had told the New York Times that he had been. They caught him.
So I want to stay on that for a second when we go ahead, but let's go back to they did this wiretapping of him, this surveillance. What happened then?
Well, for some reason, they decided that he was suspicious. And I think that's the only thing the government has ever really claimed here, that there was something about him, some reason that they had for suspicion. He was from Iraq. His name had been found in some notebooks in some armed camps in northern Iraq. That's not really unusual. He was from a well-known family. He'd come to America. A lot of people collect names, and there are a lot of armed camps in northern Iraq. So whatever it was that triggered some suspicion, they, I guess, decided eventually that they just wanted to convict him. They wanted to get him out of there. So they set up a sting operation. It was run by a guy that had been convicted of a number of felonies. The government agreed that if he would help them, they would make all of his legal troubles go away. They set him up as supposedly as an arms merchant. And he was supposed to set up some sort of an elaborate scenario, selling missiles and arms to terrorists and all this kind of thing. So what they did was they went out and they got a member of Yassin's mosque in Albany who needed money to fix up his property. And so the government informant, a guy named Malik, told this guy from the mosque, Mohammed Hussein, that he would loan him some money. He had a lot of money to loan him. He would loan him $50,000. He only had to pay him back $45,000. He could keep the other $5,000 for his properties and so on. And then slowly began to divulge that he got this money from his business in arms. He was selling missiles to people to try to liberate Kashmir from India. This was all focused on a group that was going to liberate Kashmir from India.
But so far, of course, the Inman is not involved yet, right? It's the deal,
not involved at all.
It's the informant, essentially, entrapment sort of guy, going to some other person in the mosque and loaning the guy money to fix up his house. So the Inman is not in there yet, right?
Not involved at all, not in any way.
The money that coming from the FBI informant that supposedly was the result of arms was then being loaned to somebody and then being repaid with, quote, clean money.
Right. Yeah. The only question was anything told to the imam that would have made him think that? In other words, if you went out and somebody asked you to notarize a transaction and you simply notarized the papers and then the government said, you're part of some illegal, drug smuggling, would you know that? How would you know that?
Right.
The actual issues at the trial were relatively narrow in terms of what he understood about this transaction. The government at the trial brought in a huge amount of material from his diaries, from writings. He was a writer. He's a poet. He's a brilliant man. All about stuff having to do with Kurdistan.
He's Kurdish, right?
He's Kurdish. And he came here, he's about seven years ago by the time the trial came. And all of this material was supposed to show that he had a terrorist mindset. And so every time the word jihad was used, that was focused on. Every time there's a lot of words that are very complicated and nuanced in Arabic or in Kurdish. But by using their translators, they could put their spin on it, whatever they wanted to.
Sure.
So the trial sort of became a circus, in my view, as to what his mindset was, what his beliefs were, as opposed to what he'd actually done. And so in the end, the jury acquitted him of most of the charges, but convicted him only of the last series of transactions. So it was 10 counts that he was convicted of, but they all had to do with the last transaction, which happened to be, that was the one that was in code. So he was eventually convicted, and he's now spending 15 years in Terre Haute, the Communication Management Unit. This is the Muslim prison out there.
And we've covered that prison on here. Can you tell us a little about that prison?
I had a rather bizarre experience out there. It's 2 days from New York. You have to drive out there. And I took his kids out to see him right after he'd been convicted. So we drove out, had a nice time, spent the time in the motel, and then we got to the prison. You sign in, and you go in to a small cell, and then there's a plate glass window there. So the kids could see their father through the plate glass window, and they could talk to him on a telephone. So we sat down. We were supposed to be there for 4 hours. We sat in this little room, and the kids chatted with him, and I chatted with him a little bit. At one point, I wanted to report back to other people what had been said, and so I sort of stepped back into the room, and I took out a pen, and I wrote on a piece of paper a few notes about what we had talked about. And we understood that the whole purpose of the conversation on the telephone was so that this could be monitored at all times. So right after I did this, a guard came in and said, all right, that's it, the visit is over. You're all being thrown out of here. And I said, why? And he said, because you wrote something on a piece of paper. And I said, where does it say I can't do that? How can you say I can't do that? And they said, well, when you came in here, you said that you didn't have any recording devices on you. That was
oh, my gosh.
Sign. And a pen is a recording device.
That's terrible. You spent 2 days going out there. Oh, my gosh.
You're lucky you didn't release your notes as a press release like Lynn Stewart did, because this is Michael Smith, Steve. They gave Lynn Stewart initially 30 years for that one. They play up on the fear.
So what happened then?
Well, they kicked me out, and they have never allowed me back in again. I went out on another occasion, brought the family out there, but I didn't go and see him because they wouldn't let me in. I was a bad guy.
Oh, my gosh. How old are his kids?
He has kids at 3, 7,
oh my
nine,
heavens.
And 14.
So I presume there was an appeal of the conviction.
Yes. We lost. It was a very hard, unsympathetic decision from the Court of Appeals. I have to say it was an odd decision in a way, or an odd case in a way, because right after that, there was a secret appeal. That is to say, the government filed a regular brief for the public. They then filed another brief, which was related to apparently a fair amount of secret evidence that had been accumulated, which they'd been showing the court. And I believe there was even a top secret brief, which even the prosecutor wasn't allowed to see. We then went to a secret appeal, and we don't know what they said in the secret appeal. So whatever it was, but I have to say that the appellate decision was very hard. It simply either mischaracterized what our claims were or brushed them aside and paid almost no attention to them. And we thought we had very substantial claims.
So that means that he's going to stay in there for a good part of 15 years.
We, at this point, because he spent quite a bit of time in jail before trial, so he'll probably be in there for another 10 years. We thought it was a great victory because the government had been arguing for 30 years, which would have been the standard based on all the various enhancements that they'd added.
Wow.
They could, for example, claim that there was a missile, which was a weapon of mass destruction. So that was a huge enhancement to the thing. Of course, he never saw the missile. He didn't know anything about it.
Is he a U.S. citizen?
No.
So what's going to happen when he gets released?
Normally, he would be deported back to Kurdistan. He came in as a U.N. refugee. They accepted him in the family as a U.N. refugee, and so it's a little bit more complicated. I'm not quite sure how they're going to do it. I don't think they know quite what they're going to do.
Attorney Steve Downs, I understand from your work on the RF case that you're trying to generalize this and point out the various Muslims around the country that were framed up and convicted and imprisoned, just like this defendant was. Can you tell us a little bit about this work?
Yes. Soon afterwards, we became aware of a group out in Syracuse that was representing an oncologist out there, Dr. Rafil Dafir, who had been also, we thought, framed by the government. This was a very compassionate man who had given a lot of money to help support starving people in Iraq as a result of the UN embargo. So the government at some point announced that he was funding terrorists with this charity and went after them. And then after the charges were brought, decided that they didn't have any proof that he had funded terrorists. So they brought Medicaid fraud charges against him. Most Medicaid fraud charges are where you have fictitious patients or fictitious treatments. The government never claimed that any of the patients were not given proper care or that no medicines were given. What they said was he'd filled out his paperwork incorrectly, and because he'd filled out the paperwork incorrectly, he was not entitled to any money, and so that any money he had gotten for treatment actually given or medicine actually received was a fraud. And somehow they managed to sell that to the jury. So he ended up getting 22 years, I think, in his...
Oh, my gosh.
Out in Terre Haute, in the Muslim prison also, in the CMU, along with Yassin.
So the guy that assassinated Harvey Milk gets 5 years, and this poor doctor, whose secretary, because doctors don't fill out these forms, secretaries fill out these forms, so an incorrectly filled out form by a secretary gets this doctor 22 years.
That's right.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit more about the communications, this special unit at Terre Haute. I heard your experience, but what is it exactly?
Well, it's a prison that was set aside for prisoners in which they want to restrict their communication. It's called the Communication Management Unit. What they're really trying to do, I think, is to seal them off from the prison population generally and from society at large. They're very restrictive on who can visit, who can talk to people. You have to be on an approved mailing list, on an approved phone list. Only people who can visit are people that are approved and who knew him prior to the arrest. And so it's been almost impossible to get anybody on the approved visiting list for Yacine or for any of these people. Journalists, for example, are not allowed to go. They are being treated as though they had some horrible disease that would infect anybody that came in contact with them.
It's a very good analogy, actually.
I think that's really what they're concerned about. I mean, is that they may go and talk to journalists about what's going on, or they may talk to other people in the prison population and get them stirred up. I'm not quite sure what their concerns are, because they don't entirely seem rational to me, but that's what the thing is set up as. I have a suspicion, and I may be wrong about this, but that at some point the Bush administration was thinking of closing Guantanamo and had thought of setting up something in the United States. And about that time, the Communication Management Unit was created in Terre Haute. I can't help getting the feeling, because of the size involved, the sizes of the unit is about right, that maybe they were thinking of transferring prisoners there, but that never happened. I just think the culture there is somewhat the same as Guantanamo.
Let me ask you, do the prisoners get to communicate with each other? Are they in a form of isolation? What is it like?
They seem to actually be quite free. I can't say from my own personal knowledge, and it's hard to get information easily from the prisoners because they're always being monitored. Everything is monitored. You cannot have candid communications with them about anything. But my impression is that within the prison itself, nobody seems to care very much. The prisoners are very good. They behave themselves. They're allowed to walk around most of the day and do what they want. It's only with the outside world and with the regular prison population that they are concerned.
How many people are in this special unit?
Well, I would say maybe 50 or 60. Mm-hmm. It may be a little bit less than that. There is room, I'm told, for almost 400, but it's quite undersized at this point.
We can always hope. Steve, come back to what you were saying before, because I understand that you've concerned yourself with several dozen cases of people that have been framed up around the country
right.
for the crime of breathing while Muslim.
Well, after we met with the Darfur people, we then ran into some other people, and we began to realize that all over the country there were groups that were forming around various people in their community that had been simply locked away. The government had just gone after them. And particularly one was Fahed Hashmi down in New York City. And so the three of us got together, and we decided to hold a conference up here in Albany at the law school on the whole problem. And out of that came the idea of trying to set up a database of all the people, all the Muslims in the country who had been improperly gone after, who had been incarcerated essentially because they were innocent but suspicious to the government for some reason. So we've called this Project Salaam. We've set up a website. Yeah, www.projectsalaam.org. If you go there, you'll get information about all sorts of things. One of the things that we're doing is that we just wrote to President Obama and Attorney General Holder to raise, first of all, the whole issue about what has happened under the Bush administration, where they changed the paradigms of how we prosecute people, and they decided to prosecute people who they thought were suspicious for some reason rather than people who had actually committed crimes, and that you had the whole prison population full of people who were basically innocent of committing any crimes, but that the government for some reason or another decided were suspicious. So we sent that off, and now what we're going to start doing is writing letters about specific cases, and we're going to get people to sign. We got 970 people to sign the first letter, and I'm hoping by the time we get the second letter out that deals with specific cases like, you know, a Ref's case or Dr. Dafir's case or Hashmi's case, that we'll get more people, and that each time one of these letters goes out, we're going to get more and more people, and we will slowly establish a record that people can refer to later as to who is, you know, unlawfully incarcerated, you know, just so that you'll have a central place that people can go to learn about these cases.
Well, hopefully the atmosphere will change and maybe some pressure can be brought to bear to get these people out or at least cut the time that they've been put in.
Well, I think that was initially our hope, was that common sense would finally rule. But I must say I have not been pleased with the way things are going. Attorney General Holder, as you know, took a series of pro-Bush stands on various issues involving specific cases. And, you know, I'm not optimistic at this point that he's either going to read the letters or react favorably to them.
Well, if our listeners want to get involved in some way with you, what would you ask them to do?
Well, one thing is just to visit the website, Project Salaam website. We are asking people who are interested to adopt a defendant. Go and do a little research. You can Google the name. There's often press reports. And we want to accumulate some facts on this and then eventually write the case up so that people will have a grasp of what are some of the issues involved and why this person probably shouldn't be in jail.
And how many people are we talking about?
We have about 400 people on the database.
Whoa.
Now, I can't say that all 400 are innocent. Some people are just clearly overcharged. That is to say, they may have committed some minor crime, but they were overcharged and should be there. And then other people are genuine, you know, terrorists. There probably are a few in there.
You know, Steve, this has been amazing. I do a lot of this work at Guantanamo, and I really want to thank you. And we're going to go to the website at the center and try and really build it up because, you know, I agree. We follow all these individual cases, but no one has actually done what you've done, which is try and put together the cases across the country.
Thank you very much, Steve Downs. You've been a really generous person with your time and your intelligence to the movement out there. And Michael and I really are grateful to be able to interview you. Thank you for being on Law and Disorder.
Thank you, Steve.
I'm so pleased that you called. Thank you very much.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
In the book titled George W. Bush, War Criminal, Michael Haass counts 269 war crimes that the Bush administration are liable to be prosecuted for. This book carefully documents the war crime evidence, making it quick work to investigate how George W. Bush and his regime, the military officers under his command, and the staff in his administration can be brought to justice. Author Michael Haass has written more than 30 books on human rights. He is currently Professor Emeritus of Political Science at the University of Hawaii and the Chairman of the International Academic Advisory Board of the University of Cambodia. He played a role in stopping the secret funding of the Khmer Rouge by the administration of President George H.W. Bush. He has taught political science at the University of London, Northwestern University, Purdue University, and the University of California in Riverside. Michael Haass, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you very much.
You've written what is really a dynamite book endorsed by your own Michael Ratner. The title is George W. Bush, War Criminal, with a question mark. Why do you put question mark?
I didn't. That's the publisher's idea. I guess it went to the legal department there. I asked them actually to put an italics on the question mark in my page proofs, but they didn't do that, did they?
Well, no, they didn't. The subtitle of the book is The Bush Administration's Liability for 269 War Crimes. In a nutshell, tell me what the argument of your book is.
The argument is that the four types of war crimes were all violated with great impunity by George W. Bush and members of his administration, the four being, of course, the illegality of the war, the misconduct during war militarily, the mistreatment of prisoners, and the misgovernment of the occupations of Iraq and Afghanistan.
Is the book centered on the Iraq and Afghanistan wars, or does it also talk about what the Bush-Cheney administration, or some people call the Bush-Cheney junta, did in the United States as well?
Not too much, actually, on the domestic side, although I do have narratives in each chapter that give a lot of background.
Because after all, you can't commit war crimes abroad and keep democracy at home. Let's focus on in Iraq and Afghanistan. What is your perception of why the war in Iraq initially was illegal?
The decision to indiscriminately bomb without giving proper notice to the civilian population, and then the use of illegal weapons such as daisy cutters, cluster bombs, the white phosphorus, which was a little later, of course, and depleted uranium weapons, which not only affected the civilian population in Iraq, but the American soldiers who later came in to occupy and were also adversely affected.
And what laws are violated by those usages?
I have a table in the book indicating approximately 40 international agreements that are war crimes treaties, the most prominent of which, of course, begin with the Red Cross Convention of 1864, and then going on to the Hague Conventions, the Geneva Conventions before and after World War II, and then the subsequent Convention Against Torture and Enforced Disappearances, and many, many others.
Michael Haas, let me address what's really a profound charge that you make in your book. You state that George W. Bush committed treason. How do you assert that?
Well, actually, I said that he had conduct bordering on treason because he reenacted 9 complaints stated in the Declaration of Independence against England, ignored the Constitution and federal laws, trampled on the American tradition of developing international law to bring order to world politics. And as a result, the Intelligence Committee has blamed Bush for an increase in world terrorism. Naturally, he committed no overt act. He got so close to treason that I consider this bordering on treason.
Talk to us about the question of torture once the prison camps were set up and the war was going on. And what would you characterize the Bush administration did illegally there?
Well, any kind of torture is illegal when involving prisoners of war. The question is, why did this happen? When Guantanamo first opened, the commandant said to all the representatives on the island or on the base that they were to follow Geneva Conventions. However, they couldn't get any information out of the prisoners, and so those orders were countermanded by Rumsfeld, who in turn was relying on an executive order from Bush, to try other techniques. Well, those other techniques were not too well defined, and so it was sort of try anything you can. Then these descended into great abuse and certainly torture.
What's your opinion of the memorandums that the attorneys in the Office of Legal Counsel wrote defining torture and defining what they were doing as not being torture?
Well, I'm not a lawyer. I don't have a legal opinion, but I can quote James Comey, who went with John Ashcroft to the White House to talk to David Addington and Vice President Cheney in objecting to some of these proposed memoranda and executive orders, in which he said no lawyer could possibly have approved of such a document. Whereupon David Addington is quoted as having said, "Well, I'm a lawyer and I approve." Whereupon James Comey said, "No good lawyer." The first chapter of my book is A President Without a Good Lawyer.
Continue on with your story, because we've covered about half of the war crimes, and your book, George W. Bush, War Criminal, the Bush Administration's Liability for 269 War Crimes, really lays it out. It's just an extraordinary handbook for what these people did to the Iraqis, the Afghanistan people, and to our people. Continue on with 269 war crimes that you've identified.
Most of these, of course, were the mistreatment of prisoners, because the Geneva Convention is very detailed and specific about what cannot be done. So the fact that the rule book was thrown out, and then in 2006, Bush issued an executive order to rule it back in again, with exempting the CIA, that actually the Bush executive order details exactly what had happened, and in effect is an admission of abuse. I wouldn't restrict my comments to just the prisoners at Guantanamo. There's also Bagram Air Force Base, secret detention sites, and, of course, the extraordinary renditions where individuals were sent to other countries where they were in turn tortured. And to do so, to send someone to another country and have them tortured, is itself a war crime.
What do you make of the new Obama administration's position that we have to look forward? They've clearly shown no inclination to bring to justice the perpetrators of these 269 war crimes.
Well, that question was actually put to me by one of the members of the new White House press staff going forward and not looking backward. And my comment was, war crimes are ongoing now. They are ongoing under the Obama administration. People are being victimized. People are being hurt, and people are being killed, some indiscriminately, others being beaten up at Guantanamo now. If we cannot focus on now, which apparently is not happening, then we're not even learning lessons from the past, let alone compensating those who were abused and are deserving of compensation. Indeed, the failure to compensate is itself a war crime. So we can't ignore the past.
Elaborate on that, please, some more, Michael, when you say that war crimes are being committed now. Where and what?
At Guantanamo, the following four crimes are being committed: failure to transmit legal documents to prisoners, secret judicial proceedings that people can't monitor, refusal to cooperate in investigations and prosecution of torturers, the reckless endangerment of health in prison, the violating of medical ethics, that is, the force feedings of prisoners who are on hunger strikes, indefinite imprisonment of children, that is going on, cruel treatment, that is, the beatings after the force feedings, repeated punishments, corporal punishment, and for that matter, the executive orders issued by Obama simply not being followed, and certainly no prohibition on extraordinary renditions, which brought people first to some site and then to Guantanamo. Whereas on the battlefield, we have the bombing in Pakistan, which has no authorization from the UN, the indiscriminate killing, basically the activity in Pakistan by the United States is killing innocent people, destroying undefended targets, is obviously bombing a neutral country. There's been no advance warning. Basically, the people killed that they actually are trying to kill are extrajudicial executions of people who should be rounded up and put on trial. So these are just some of the, what I've counted as 22 war crimes since the inauguration of President Obama.
You're a political scientist. How do you explain this, that there was clearly a popular mandate to break from what the Bush-Cheney people have done? And nonetheless, it seems like there's more of a continuation of the old policy than anything much removed from what people had hoped it would be. How do you explain that?
When I gave the press secretary designate's answer to that question, I also gave him one of my blogs on uswarcrimes.com, in which I outlined what the president should do to stop war crimes upon being inaugurated. What he did was, of course, focus entirely on Geneva Conventions and Guantanamo. He did not give new instructions to the military in the field. He did not give new instructions to those parts of the occupation of Afghanistan that the military engages in that are non-military. And my explanation was that either he's unaware, hasn't read what I sent to him, or he's being very, very cautious. Now, and of course, he gave 30 days for compliance with his executive orders involving the Geneva Conventions at Guantanamo. But these things are going on in Guantanamo now, according to press reports. And those 30 days are about to elapse on Saturday. There was supposed to be a review to determine compliance. So we will find out next week whether there in actuality is compliance. But somewhere down the chain of command, from the president to the people who are beating up prisoners in Guantanamo, the word has not been relayed, or the standard operating procedures have not been rewritten.
If you had your druthers, what would you want to be done starting tomorrow with respect to the 269 war crimes that you catalog in your great book?
The thesis of the book is to have a truth commission bring out all these war crimes so that people know in the public, know what is a war crime, what is not a war crime, that such ignorance exists. And the press also rarely asks an expert when something happens, is this or is this not a war crime? Sometimes there is a quote, but I asked Dana Priest a question on her blog, why don't you call these war crimes? And there was no answer on that blog to my question, although other people were asked. This was last week. So a lot of this, I think, could be traced to ignorance, but much of it to caution, because after all, there's Jack Cafferty, who called Rumsfeld a war criminal on his TV program, and then the CEO of CNN came with some lawyers to tell him not to do that anymore. So there's been a lot of pressure exerted, and obviously that was in response to the Pentagon calling CNN and saying, you know, you can't allow this to happen. This is the environment in which we live. What can Obama do about it? Well, he certainly should be issuing new executive orders governing the war in Afghanistan and the activities in Pakistan that are quite illegal.
Is it illegal for Obama to do what he just did? It was announced in the papers, sending 17,000 more troops. There are 36,000 there already. 17,000 more troops to Afghanistan?
Not really, because the UN has authorized the International Security Assistance Force in Afghanistan. So if those troops are being sent to that entity, then it's supported by the UN Security Council resolutions that have been adopted every year. However, there's a separate unit of American forces that's not part of that. And that separate unit has also been authorized by the UN Security Council. So their mere presence is actually sanctioned. It's their activity subsequent to being sent there that needs to be better monitored. And that word has not apparently accompanied this transfer of troops.
When you say their activity, specifically, what are they doing in Afghanistan that you would object to?
Consider it a military action, when often it's a police action. The police and the military operate very differently. So if you have a person that you're after inside a house, the police would have a bullhorn, would ask people to leave and for the person inside thereafter to come out and surrender. But the military, quite often, particularly if they're being fired upon, will look upon this quite differently and will fire back at the entire house, killing perhaps not the person they're seeking, but all the civilians inside who perhaps were shooting at who knows what, maybe not even at the American. In other words, the military operates on split-second timing decisions. The police take their time and do a very thorough and professional job. But we've not sent police. We've sent military.
Professor Michael Haas, let me ask you this. You said before that you thought what needs to be done is a truth and reconciliation. So what the Bush-Cheney administration did comes out. What do you say to the argument, and it's been made on this show, that we already know what they've done? It's been fairly well cataloged, for say, example, in your book, George W. Bush, War Criminal, or in Jane Mayer's book, The Dark Side, and numerous other studies. What do you say to the argument, well, we don't need a truth commission because the truth is pretty much out there. We need prosecutions.
Well, what's out there is hearsay. We need sworn testimony. Of course, some of the war crimes are documents signed by George W. Bush. And so some, yes, are out there, but others are reports from the press, which ultimately can't be cited in court. But sworn testimony would be very helpful and also would pinpoint those things that have been reported by Jane Mayer, and of course I do the same thing. I report what I get from other sources. I've never been to Guantanamo or Iraq or Afghanistan or Pakistan for that matter. And in a way, the book outlines what would be done, what would be the parameters of a truth commission.
And would that truth commission offer clemency to those who testified in front of it, or would it be an inquiry preparatory to indictments and prosecution?
Well, that depends on who draws it up and how they draw it up. And I really am not going to answer that question because I'm not quite sure how to answer it at this point, because once several senators come out in favor of a truth commission, I'm wondering what they really have in mind, and it doesn't seem to have gained support. But when it seems that there is going to be a truth commission for real, then I will answer that kind of a question with a blog on my website, uswarcrimes.com.
Yeah, give me that website again so that listeners can write it down.
uswarcrimes, all one word, .com.
We're speaking with Michael Haas, who's just had published a very fine book that I'd recommend everybody, George W. Bush, War Criminal. 269 war crimes are cataloged in this book. Michael Ratner wrote the blurb on the back cover. This is a book that people should have. It's really one of the essential documents in what the Bush-Cheney regime did. Let me ask you, if I might, a personal question. What was it that led you to write such a book?
I was writing a textbook on international human rights. I'm a scholar, a political scientist, and there was no such textbook, so I decided to write a thorough and comprehensive textbook. One of the chapters would inevitably be war crimes. While I was reading the Geneva Conventions to summarize them for the purpose of the chapter, I was also reading the newspaper, and I realized that I'd better finish the textbook very fast to get a book out on the war crimes that were being violated, because item by item in the Geneva Convention is very dry reading, but I can make it much more interesting by colloquializing the crimes and then providing the evidence from various sources, which, as I mentioned, was autobiographical accounts, press reports. I even emailed attorneys that were working on cases to get additional information. So, and I emailed some members of the press to get additional information. And then I quit my academic job because I realized I couldn't finish with any degree of speed if I had to grade papers. So I began to relentlessly get up at 5 in the morning, go to bed at 1, day after day, to finish this book. So it would be coming out just a few days before the inauguration of the new president.
What's been the reaction to your book, George W. Bush, War Criminal, which outlines 269 war crimes of the Bush-Cheney administration? What's been the public and the professional reaction to it?
Well, one of the reactions was, of course, what you mentioned, the endorsement by Mike Ratner. And, of course, my classmate Vince Bugliosi has endorsed it. Perhaps even more interesting is that the sole surviving Nuremberg prosecutor wrote a foreword, Ben Ferenz. So the positive, of course, is also shared with my academic colleagues. But on the negative side, I've had such reactions as, I didn't know he was a war criminal. I can't believe it, because the person didn't know what a war crime was and hadn't really been following the news that much. Another one is, well, Hitler certainly committed war crimes. This is in no way in that same league. But, of course, in the book I point out that the war crimes of the Nazis were wholesale, and Bush's are more retail. Why should we excuse one murderer and only prosecute serial murderers? It doesn't make much sense in legal terms. So that was my response to at least two of those comments, and no doubt there'll be others.
Are you on a national tour to promote your book?
Well, I came to a conference here in New York, and I'm going back to Los Angeles tomorrow, but meanwhile, I'm up in Albany giving a talk at the Albany Law College later today. So you call that a book tour. That's a book tour, but it's a pretty short one.
And if people want to get in touch with you or get your blog, Michael Haas, how do they reach you?
Well, on the blog, there's an About the Author tab. You just click that on, and way at the bottom is an email address, mikehaas@aol.com. And that's where I've been getting my comments.
Give that blog again, would you please?
U.S. War Crimes, all one word, .com.
Michael Haas, it's been really a pleasure and an honor to have you on Law and Disorder. You've done terrific and difficult work on this, and you've really set an example, I think, for people who want to make this country a little better place. And we really appreciate your coming on the show.
Well, it's delightful to be here. And yes, that is my intention. I would like the United States to live up to its values.
Thank you, Michael Haas.
Thanks again.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.
sounds returned pure and easy. Thank you.